C1F. Number 5A.
We started yesterday with that chapter, Footsteps of Truth, by reminding ourselves that these are footsteps of truth and not footsteps of mortals towards truth. It is truth itself that reveals itself as a steps and stage of consciousness which shows us how divinity is embracing humanity in life experience. It is that wonderful chapter which should relieve ourselves of the belief that there is an absolute and that there is a relative. Absolute and relative are only standpoints, they are not entities as such. It is not so that there is an absolute realm and that there is a relative realm. There are not two realms. There is only one being, one realm. And naturally we can look at it from the standpoint of truth itself and can look at it of how truth demonstrates itself or manifests itself, makes itself known in spite of the mortal. Then we have the so-called relative standpoint. But it's still the divine working human changes. So if we can drop that belief within ourselves that we are still humans and somehow have to reach the divine, the better it is, because we are the sons of God. And this is brought out right in the beginning where Mrs. Eddy said in the introductory paragraphs that truth makes a new creature, that all things pass away and behold, all things are become new. So it is truth itself that makes a new creature. We participate in this creation in the measure as we accept truth as the only standpoint, as we accept the divinely subjective standpoint, therefore the divinity, and divinity always embraces humanity. This first part of the chapter shows how human the divine is, therefore the humanity of divinity. Recently I was reading a book on Karl Barth. You know, Karl Barth is one of the leading theologians in the German-speaking field. I think he is well known too in the English-speaking field. And he was participating at a conference with sociologists and physicists and so on. And he was asked what he is thinking about the whole conference, where it was presented where humanity is in its struggle with living together and so on. And he said, well, to him, this is theology, because he says that God is very human. And I was surprised to find this from him, because this is the new trait in theology, which is being brought out more and more. Really, the rendering was that he was speaking of the humanism of God. Now, this is what Mrs. Eddy tries to show here, that the synonymous terms are very human, that they have a humanism. So we could speak of the humanism of the divine mind, or the humanism of the divine spirit, or the humanism of divine soul. That's how far we went yesterday. And she would show that understanding mind, God, mind, capitalized mind, has a humanism, namely that this mind then becomes the mind. Now, I must be very careful how I word it, you see, becomes the mind of humans. It becomes our mind. It becomes the mind of man. That's the humanism of mind. So that we begin to realize that we have no other mind but that mind which is God. That's the humanism of mind. In the old theological belief, you looked up to God as God, and we looked up perhaps to God as mind and said, yes, God is mind. Were we really accepting at the same time the humanism of that mind, namely that that mind which is God is our mind, is my mind, is our mind, is the only mind? It all depends from which standpoint we look at it. We can vary this and say it is my mind, it is our mind, which unfolds, as we have seen yesterday, the law of loving our neighbor. The moment we have only one mind, and then she would show that it is the all mind and puts all in italics. I never know if it's italics or italics, and every time you will tell me, and every time then I am saying, now which one was it? Yeah. But still it's all mind. And then, so that's what we saw yesterday in the first subject, and she showed through the subtones the way to the realization of this one mind. Then in the second subject she would show that in the measure as we understand the one spirit, we find the humanism of spirit, and the humanism of spirit, she showed that we find the reality of the spiritual man. We find the true reality of man. So that's the humanism of spirit. You see, it is very practical. That's why she says in this chapter right at the beginning that the scientific unity which exists between God and man, it is not the unity between man and God. See, the first four chapters have shown the unity between man and God. Prayer started in that way and said that Jesus' prayer were deep and conscientious protests of truth, of man's likeness to God. It was man's unity with truth and love. It was the unity of man with God that was shown in the first four chapters. But then, once you have found that unity, then we realize that that unity which man has found with God is a unity that is ever operative as God's unity with man. And the second four chapter of the textbook points out that that God is one with man, which naturally gives the sense that that God works as man, that God operates as man, that God is the impulsion behind everything and behind our whole life practice. So here in this eighth chapter she says that the scientific unity which exists between God and man must be wrought out in life practice. God can't stay still. We cannot make God static. He is a dynamic power. He is self-existent, all right, but here in these chapters on the Christ, he is also self-expressed. And so one can't help feeling that because God is God and is self-expressed, he expresses himself by himself. And so we feel that man is wrought out in life practice through the impulsion of this one principle. This shows very clearly how these Christ chapters really bring about the change of standpoint from approaching to God and then changing it to the divinely subjective standpoint of God working as its idea. In the third subject, soul, we have seen that in the measure as we understand soul through the senses of soul, that soul has a humanism. The humanism of soul is that soul is that term for being which gives us a sense that everything is unchangeable, has unchangeable, immortal identity, which does not vary, and therefore cannot alter, so that the humanism of soul is that we find the immortality of man, the true, unchangeable, indestructible identity of man. We can therefore not study the nature of God as soul, like Socrates did, without finding the humanism of soul, without finding the conviction that all the identities of being, inclusive man, are immortal, that nothing on earth can change them, kill them, destroy them, hurt them, damage them, and so on. So that within us grows the humanism of soul as the immortal identity of our true selfhood. That's how far we got yesterday. And to the subject today now goes on to principle, and in principle she shows that an understanding of that one principle reveals the humanity of that principle, the humanism of that principle. And that principle's humanity is that principle always demonstrates itself as man and the universe. That principle is never without practice. That principle, if principle would only be self-existent, therefore static, then it would have no humanism. It would not demonstrate itself nilly-willy or willy-nilly. One or both. would demonstrate itself and demonstrate itself as a higher sense of manhood. I just can't get away from the beauty of evolution, because evolution to me is always one of the biggest proof that there is a immaterial principle working, because all the new stages in evolution have always come about not through the laws of matter, but in spite of the natural laws. It's like the theory of Dunui, even Teilhard de Chardin, in his more mystical theory of evolution, he shows really that matter has not evolved. That, as we said yesterday, that professor of biology said that really evolution or creation is the lifting off the restraints from matter, that is creation, that there must exist a spiritual principle which drives matter or which impels matter to fall back on itself, to give up its limitation, to give up its claim. And this lifting off the restraints from matter is showing a greater liberty, which is shown, therefore, a greater variety, a greater diversification in being. And so there is a constant upward trend in evolution, an upward trend which has not been conceived by the human brain. The human brain in the way of evolution is something that happened just yesterday. If we think of the whole time of billions of years that have gone before, where there was no human brain and yet there was evolution. So it isn't the human brain that is so intelligent that it can bring forward humanity or the universe. It is the infinite mind that has a humanism, and that humanism shows itself as the enlightenment of the human brain, of the human mind, to perceive the higher truth and the higher light in being. That's why we are in such a wonderful position to see that we can perceive new things which nobody up to now has seen and which we haven't understood, that new vision can break on us. Very naturally, the moment we don't try to find this new vision through human reasoning, but in letting go of the belief that there is intelligence in matter or in brain, and opening our thoughts to the very fact that the divine mind is constantly revealing itself, because the divine mind is infinite intelligence, is infinite enlightenment, is infinite insight, and in one view just can overlook everything. And so that one mind has in itself the willingness and the drive and the impulsion to make itself known. It doesn't want to withhold. It wants to manifest itself. And in the measure, therefore, as we open up our mind to the fact that there is just the divine mind, in that measure the divine mind is our mind. That's the humanism of mind. And the humanism of spirit, of principle, here shows that as we open up our thought to the one divine principle of being, which exists because being is ordered and has law, is not just chaotic. If we open up our thought to the divine principle demonstrates itself as its as principle, and that's the humanism of principle, namely that it demonstrates itself as man. This is what we have here in the epitomes. I summarized it by saying that scientific healing based on God demonstrates itself as man. You see, the divinity is that it is based on God, the humanity of it is that it is demonstrating itself as man. We can't separate that scientific unity which exists between God and man. If we try to do it, we only do it in our beliefs. In our beliefs, we may try to separate it, and all the religious thinking has done that, good and proper, that it has separated God and man, and therefore it is our belief that has been hindering that the divine principle demonstrates itself as man. Actually, when we begin to realize this, you see, we begin to feel that we don't have to make many demonstrations. To have to make demonstrations over this and that and the other. But when we understand this, then we see that we only have to make one demonstration, namely to open up our thought to the understanding that there is one principle at work, and that one principle at work knows better than we do what has to be solved or what has to be demonstrated as man and the universe. And we let really the infinitude of God's own conception of himself be at work and express itself. Gives a very different sense of demonstrating Christian Science, if I may put that in brackets or in inverted commas. This demonstrating Christian Science is usually seen as demonstrating Christian Science in this and that and the other circumstance, but really, as you will see, she is leading us now, step by step, to the level of absolute Christian Science, where absolute Christian Science is only dealing with the essence of evil, and not with the various concrete forms of evil or of error. It is giving us the steps that lead to the absolute demonstration that if we live and move and have our being in the one principle, that principle takes care of all the situations necessary. Gives you a wonderful peace, I would say, a wonderful peace which says, I don't have to make my demonstrations. Gives the sense that you are big enough to let the whole principle flow in and flow to the universe as the infinite demonstration of that principle. If I can see principle as unlimited, then I have the unlimited demonstration of principle as man. Well, we'll see that as we go on. Here, as the first subtone, she will always start leading thought upward to the right standpoint and starts with mind and says, in Christian Science, healing are proofs of divine mind and not indications of unnatural mental conditions. This is a most important statement, I would say. Namely, showing that the healing work of Christian Science is proving the power of the one mind. And she says that because she knows, and today she would be surprised to see in a far bigger way, how many facets of non-material healing we are practiced today in the world. At Mrs. Eddy's time, I think there were only a few ways of non-material healings, like mesmerism, Quimby, and so on, something very new, but practically unique. And her discovery of healing through the divine mind instead of through the human mind or through the human will was something unique. But today one is surprised to see and hear and witness how many different non-material mental systems of healing there exist and are practiced and with so-called success. Therefore, let's see that just a mental healing is not Christian Science healing, and that there can be many so-called mental healings and system of mental healing. But just because they are mental, they don't mean that they are Christian Science. Here is the point. Also, if you only think over in the development of the Christian Science movement, we can witness how practically every other 10 years the practice of Christian Science changed from one method to the other, and they always had success. Think first how they practiced practically on the same basis as Quimby. It was mesmerism, rubbing the skull and arguing something, and arguing the truth audibly, and they got their healing. Then arguing silently, it also worked. And afterwards, not arguing about the case of the patient, but what they called impersonal treatment, just the practitioner arguing himself out of the belief that he has to heal a patient, and it worked too. Then came that period where everything was misunderstood what Kimball was teaching, and they were healing on that basis, you know, on the basis that, what was it? That the idea about which liver is the counterfeit is perfect in God. And they healed them right and left. They heal with faith healings. You see, healing, as she says here, must be based on divine mind. And not is not just a unnatural mental state. It's a terrific point of insight that is necessary and has to come in this world. The whole world is beginning to realize the mental nature of matter. I mean, even back to older concept, one always has in one way or the other seen right back from in the time of the Greeks up to the present age that matter somehow is a mental concept. And today with psychology and psychotherapy and so on, with psychosomatic medicine, more and more the mental and psychical nature of disease is recognized. And the world feels that now they have made a step forward. All right, it may be a step forward, but a very dangerous one. And one has to be very careful, because a mental concept of matter is far worse than a solid, old substance matter concept, because mentality is fluid, is apt for good and evil, is hidden, is able to change, is not so easily recognizable as matter, and so one feels it is a more secret sphere that is touched. And therefore the solution is only then when mankind wakes up to see that the universe is not a mental picture, as we saw also yesterday, but that it is or must be seen as the idea of the divine mind, capital mind, capital M in mind. This is the great challenge that seems to come, because only then, when the world begins to realize that, then they begin to realize that all is governed by ideas, because the divine mind governs through ideas.